It is my great pleasure to welcome, for the first time to Many Rivers Books and Tea, the author of this beautifully produced book, The Holy Universe, A New Story of Creation for the Heart, Soul, and Spirit, David Christopher. Mr. Christopher, 20 years ago, was on the corporate track in Silicon Valley when he began to reawaken to the serious plight of the planet, including mass extinction of species, deep injustices in societies, as well as the spiritual desolation of the modern world. Leaving those careers behind, he pursued a path of learning and teaching about our need to face the ecological, social, and spiritual crises of our age. I believe this book is, in fact, the product of his work. We are delighted to welcome him to Many Rivers Books and Tea for the first time. Please join me in welcoming David Christopher.
So, I was hungry for a holy text. I had been raised in the Episcopal Church since I was just a kid, and I remember I didn't really understand what was going on. I didn't know what they were talking about. I didn't know all the, who Jesus was and all this. And it was a very childish notion. We just simply go to church and we do things that are kind of boring. And at a certain point, I remember, just as an aside, I do remember at one point, however, singing the song about Jesus and how he took away my sin. And I remember being flabbergasted and bewildered because I had no idea, even though I had no idea who this man was, all I know is that he had taken something from me and I had no idea how I was going to get it back. So that was my understanding. But then as I began to understand what I was being taught, what I was being given, really, and as I got older, went through high school and college, learned of other faiths and other worldviews and other conflicting worldviews, conflicting ways of looking at the world, I left that behind. But there was always something missing in my life. I went through the corporate track. I remember flying. I used to fly airplanes for a living, too. I was a flight instructor for a long time. And we'd laugh about, well, let's go burn some dinosaurs. This is before I had any consciousness about what that really meant, what we were doing. I have a lot of carbon karma to work off, by the way, about 4,000 hours worth. So this is, 4,000 hours in the air burning dinosaurs and all that carbon dioxide. I'm sorry. I'm doing my... Yes, tisk tisk. And then I ran into the works of a man named Thomas Berry and Brian Swim. And a nun of all people, a nun named Sister Mary McGillis, who were telling a new creation story based on science, that it was informed by science. And I loved it. I lapped it up, wanted more. And as I was learning, as I was reading their books and absorbing their material and meeting them actually in their own seminars, I still felt there was something missing, because I really missed the sound and the cadence of the scripture that I grew up with way back when. I missed the lyricism of the liturgy and all the material that we were being taught was fascinating, but there was a part of me that wanted more. My gut wanted more. My soul wanted more than just the academic retelling of the facts of the scientific story of the universe. So, seeing nothing out there, I took the audacious step after I was complaining to someone who encouraged me to do something about this lack of poetry around the scientific story. I decided to go ahead and take the audacious step of actually writing a creation story. And what came to me was this dialogue between a seeker and a sage. Two people who talk about the story of creation. And the seeker comes to the sage with a problem of having lost his job, but more important, having lost his way in the modern world. And And one of the things that the sage tells the seeker is that, you know, part of what I think your problem might be is that you don't have a story. You don't have a larger story on which to place your own personal stories. The story of creation. I don't get the sense that you know why you're here. So why don't I tell you a story and see if it resonates with you? And so the sage tells this story beginning from the very beginning of the universe, all the way back 13.8 billion years ago. So this is what the sage starts with. The infinite and the creation of the cosmos. It was the beginning of all beginnings. It was a time of no time, for time did not exist. A place of no place, for space did not exist. It was a beginning like no other, for there was no before. There was no time, there was no place, there was only the infinite and the unfathomable mystery. And the unfathomable mystery was all that was to be. And all that was to be was small, smaller than the tiniest particle in the tiniest atom, in the tiniest dream. Although, there was nowhere from which to see how small all that was to be was, for there was no outside and no inside. No here and no there. No now and no then. No darkness and no light. There was nothing save a whisper of what might be. An infinitesimal, indescribable, unfathomable mystery. And out of the unfathomable mystery, the infinite called forth to itself. It called forth space. It called forth time. It called forth being. And in that ecstatic instant, the universe slammed exploding outward into existence with a jubilant and breathtaking beauty, brightness, energy, violence, power, and glory of a trillion newborn stars. It was a perfect explosion. 1 trillionth of a second faster, and the universe would collapse back into itself, unfulfilled. 1 trillionth of a second faster, and the universe would spin out, dissipating into nothingness, never to create stars, galaxies, planets, life, nor us. A perfect explosion. And in the instance of this perfect explosion, the infinite began a brilliant and fierce cycle of gloriously creating, violently destroying, and then gloriously creating once more, as if it knew what it was doing. So that is the beginning of the story that the sage tells. And then moving into the story of the 7 creations of particles, forces and energy, galaxies, stars, planets, and then life, and then the web of life. And so the story continues in that manner, and what I want to do is I want to skip through to the creation and emergence. Hello, hi. The creation and the emergence of the web of life. And the emergence of the web of life came reflected 6 essences of the universe. Let's see if I can remember them. The first one being emergence and unpredictability, flexibility, flow of energy and material, relation, everything being in relation with one another, creation and destruction. I found those 5 as I was researching the science on this, and there was one missing that the science didn't pay attention to that I thought was really important, and that was the essence of beauty, because the universe is beautiful. And so I decided to write that into the story, and I was so thrilled when I read James Lovelock. He has a book called The Ages of Gaia. James Lovelock is the man who came up with the Gaia theory. The scientist he's actually writing a lot of books now saying we're in big trouble, let's stop heating up the planet. But even so, he wrote in the back of one of his books, you know, science is going to have to pay attention to beauty at some point. And I was so thrilled. It's like, ooh, a scientist said beauty. How cool. So this is what the story has to say about beauty. And the web of life brought beauty into its creations. It wove symmetrical tapestries within each being. It splashed perfumes and colors across fields of flowers and groves of trees that insects might more quickly find their nectars. It purified the waters with the music of creeks and waterfalls. It gave melody to the birds and calls to the animals as they sang warnings and welcomes to each other. It wove tastes and smells into plants. Some bore sweetness, inviting animals to partake of their offerings of food in exchange for scattering of seeds. Others bore bitterness, warning of poisons and whispering of medicines held within. It created soft furs, strong, smooth feathers and scales, and warm nests and dens that its children might find comfort and thrive. Thus the web of life reflects the essence of beauty. That beauty shall be bound throughout the web of life, pointing the way toward harmony, usefulness, and mystery. In the delicate fronds of the ferns glowing green in the forests, beauty shall be found. In the grace of the lioness chasing down the gazelle as they dance the circle of birth and death, beauty shall be found. In the magnificent violence of the volcano, and also of the thunderstorm, and also in the tranquil morning mists across an infant African savanna, beauty shall be found. Beauty shall be found throughout the web of life, for it is woven throughout the universe. And one day the universe shall stand upright and behold itself, breathless in silent awe. And that last line foreshadows the emergence of humanity. That's a line I actually took directly from Brian Swim, who said, "We are the universe come to life. We are the universe in the form of a human being." Now, I want to read a little bit about the emergence of the humanity, because I really like this section and I don't always get to read it. So this talks about what happened 65 million years ago, after the asteroid. The latest science saying that an asteroid hit Earth about 65 million years ago and caused a mass extinction. And I'll just continue right with that. Surviving through the fire, dust, and ice of the fifth great extinction were small creatures whose blood was warm within themselves and who developed deep bonds with each other and with their offspring. Over millions of years, these creatures grew larger, stronger, more beautifully complex, and more intelligent. One of these creatures developed hands that could grasp as it traveled from tree to tree. Its descendants ventured forth from these trees. They learned to walk upright, freeing their hands to make ever more intricate tools and weapons. They learned to harness fire. They created more intricate sounds with their voices as they called to one another and began to create greater nuances of expression. And it came to pass, not long ago, perhaps only 50 or 100 millennia, that one of these upright grasping animals of fire saw her reflection in the waters of the river, as she had done many times before. And as before, she sensed that she was alive, that Earth was alive, that the universe was alive. She was once again filled with awe at the power of the infinite and marveled at the creations of Earth and the web of life. She took a stick near the bank of the river. She drew a spiral in the soft mud and gazed intently at it as she felt the creative force of the infinite flowing through her and through everything around her. Feelings and images rose up within this powerful flow. She returned to the clan, telling them of these feelings and images that arose within her by the side of the river. And they understood her, for others had also felt similar feelings and seen similar images. And as the clan embraced these mysterious feelings and images, as it began to know itself and its place in the cosmos, a story began to form. Thus began the story of ancient mind. So, what I want to do now is, since I'm not a great lecturer, I have to know what people are thinking. So what I'm going to do here, if you wouldn't mind, is I'd like you to pair up. And just simply, we're going to talk about just a simple question of what strikes you as you listen to the dialogues that I'm reading. I'm just going to leave it as vague and open as that, as wide open as that. And we're going to split people up a little bit because you guys know it. So how about you guys? You never saw him before?
No.
Were you afraid or something? I noticed you were holding on to him.
Friendly.
Oh, okay. All right, how about you guys work together?
It's true.
You two, and then you two? And then you two? Oh, okay. All right, well, how about you two?
Okay.
And you two? With Betty?
No.
And then you two here. Bye, Deborah. Don't worry about it. Okay, if the other person hasn't had a chance to talk yet, if you'd switch in a couple seconds, finish your thought.
Watch out, the next
guy. Okay, if you would finish your thought. Hello.
It's quite all right.
Okay, if you could finish your thought and come forward. Bring your attention forward. Yeah, I guess that isn't quite the right way to do it. This is the hard part.
Sorry.
probably one around here.
Okay, so I'd be curious to hear just a couple of reactions. Anyone who would like to share a thought?
Well, we agree that you're very lyrical in your expression.
Thank you.
I was interested in the fact that you missed the liturgy of the Episcopal Church.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think it's very beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
That's my tradition. And I can see where you were inculcated with an idea of the beauty of words
mm-hmm.
from your early experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. The King James Bible is...
Oh, yeah.
There's some things in it that I don't like, you know, especially when there's a lot of smiting going on with bringing children. But they tell it in such a beautiful way. And I did miss that poetry. I remember actually seeing a comparison of the King James Bible with the New Living Bible and the New International Version, and how the other
they just
fall flat. Yeah.
The mark.
Yeah. Go ahead. You had a thought?
I was saying that it's poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking science and you're speaking in poetry. I think it's really
yeah. Okay. Thank you. One more?
I sort of thought there was a lightness put around the creation story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I really appreciated the aspect of, you know, well, we've got to include beauty.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, you know, it's an uplifting kind of reflection for where we're at right now.
Oh yeah, I think it's vital. There's a word that I really dislike. Well, okay, I hate resources, natural resources, as if they're ours to do whatever we wish to with. And actually, it's part of one of the dialogues when we go back and forth. Well, what's a better than better word than resource? It's bounty. Could you imagine if politicians talked about bounty instead of resources?
Wow.
Or we talk about human resources to large. Oh God. But the idea of bounty gives me a sense of like give and take, like
mm-hmm.
an offering, a gift. Like, and I need to be a little more grateful and respectful of what's been given to me. So that's one of my hopes, is that word, the old word, begins to die off, and we start using this new word in this new way, bounty, the bounty of the web of life. All those kind of sappy things that you're not supposed to say, because it starts to reveal some love for creation. Go ahead.
Well, I've always identified that line in the Bible, in the very beginning, it says, and God gave man dominion
mm-hmm.
over all these things.
That's one translation.
Right. That's the one I learned.
That is the English translation of the Greek translation of the Aramaic and a few other probably
mm-hmm.
scattered in there.
And I always thought it was always a little bit of a red flag.
Well, yes.
And that's a convenient way of thinking about things. And
well,
that
the
makes everything into a resource.
Yes, and we're going to get to that in a second. In fact,
it makes it's all ours.
Yeah, yes.
And how would you translate that?
The word dominion, I forget what the actual, I heard a translation, it was actually not dominion, it was more of stewardship,
uh-huh.
rather than domination. But then the boys got hold of it, and they did their translation, and what are you going to do? What I want to do is I want to read a little bit of the dialogue back and forth between the seeker and the sage. To give you a taste of that. Before I continue with this story, I want to ask you something, said the sage. Where in this story would modern mind tell us that consciousness comes into play? Consciousness, meaning awareness, right? Asked the seeker. Yes. Awareness of surroundings, awareness of self. Well, when humans came into the picture, that's when awareness kicks in, said the seeker. You mean that consciousness emerged with humans? Asked the sage. Well, yeah. The seeker thought for a moment. But I have a feeling you're about to say that's not true. You're about to say that that's not true. The sage laughed. Very observant of you. Yes, this idea reveals a deep conceit within the story of modern mind. the idea that consciousness is the exclusive domain of humanity. Yet even microscopic creatures move away from dangers and move away from dangers and toward food. Isn't that being conscious? Isn't that being aware? Well, I guess, but it's not like they know what they're doing, said the seeker. Really, said the sage. I'm not going to belabor the point because it is well outside of your experience. Or should I say, outside of the stories that you've been given by modern mind. What I ask you to consider is how each species might have its own collective consciousness, and that we are a young species, that plants, which are hundreds of millions of years older than us, might have learned much in their own evolution and might have much to teach us. The seeker shook his head. I don't know, that sounds a bit weird. Allow me to get even weirder, said the sage. Our conceits cause us to overlook the stories of other creatures, the story of consciousness and awareness of all other creatures. Perhaps birds are not just calling for only for evolutionary purposes. Perhaps they're singing the stories of the day, retelling their own histories to one another, and to us if we care to listen. The seeker furrowed his brow and crossed his arm. Telling stories? That sounds far-fetched, really. Is it because this is not possible, said the sage, or because you've not paid attention to this possibility? By this, I mean forms of consciousness beyond human consciousness, the basis of deep intuition, which you deny, which modern mind denies, even though it is through such mysterious intuitive leaps that modern science has developed. Well, I don't know. I'm a bit skeptical, said the seeker. Your skepticism, which serves you well, is also your curse. It is your first reactive response to the mystery. Your highly developed intellect, which also serves you well, is yet another curse. Endlessly analyzing data, pursuing logical explanations, insisting that one must exist, and is the only one worth pursuing even when you see no explanation. Modern mind has taught you to ignore, even denigrate your own intuition to the point where you are a stranger even to yourself. So that gives a sense of some of the dialogue between the two. And the story that continues then with the creation of ancient mind, as I alluded to before, with the person standing by the riverside and drawing the spiral. And the sage tells a story of three minds: ancient mind, modern mind, and planetary mind. And ancient mind is what emerged anywhere from 50 to 100,000 years ago, depending on which scientist you talk with. And I pegged it at the formation of language, where we started using language to communicate one with one another. That's where I put Homo sapiens creating what I call ancient mind. And let me just read to you a bit of the story of ancient mind. The overarching story that ancient mind told itself was this. Earth is alive. Everything within the universe is alive. We are but one species of many in the grand kinship of the web of life. And though we are subject to the ways and lessons of the web of life, we are still an intimate part of its family. And through the web of life, we are connected to the totality of the infinite. Now, that is the overarching story that I say we told ourselves. And I realize this is obviously a dramatic oversimplification, because we had 10,000 cultures as we emerged out of Africa and spread across the world. We've created many, many languages, many, many stories. But the overarching story was one of connection. It had to be, because if you didn't know which animals were good to eat and which were good to run away from, if you didn't know which plants were good to eat and which ones were medicines and which ones were poisonous, if you weren't connected on that intimate level with your environment, you wouldn't survive. So ancient mind had to be connected. And from that, all the stories were ones of connection. Contrast that to the story of modern mind, which about 10,000 years ago, when we started getting serious about systemic agriculture, not that we didn't practice agriculture before, we did as a species, but we started practicing systemic agriculture, and we started focusing on few crops and few animals, we started settling into villages and not have and didn't have as much of a nomadic lifestyle, and grew cities, chiefdoms, and even in empires and nation states, the story we started to tell ourselves was one of separation. And the fascinating thing that I realized as I was researching that this is that, especially for me, the Abrahamic traditions are the ones I'm most familiar with. Not that I know Islam or Judaism that well, but I knew Christendom pretty well, Christianity. The stories were ones of separation. All the stories of modern mind are of separation to a larger or to a smaller or larger degree. And all their worldview is about how do you get back to connection. I thought that was fascinating. So modern mind actually caused the split and then started telling itself stories of how do you get back to that. I actually stole that little ditty from Joseph Chilton Pierce, way back when he wrote the Crack in the Cosmic Egg, if any of you are familiar with that one. So the story of modern mind then was one of separation. And with the Industrial Revolution and the Renaissance and the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution happening in Europe, this story of separation became even more profound. And this is the story that it told itself. This overarching story that modern mind told itself was this: the universe is dead. The earth is only an insignificant rock spinning off into a lifeless cosmos. Humanity is a mere accident. Indeed, all of life is a vacuous accident. And while the universe somehow creates many fantastic things, and humanity is the pinnacle of this improbable process, humanity must struggle in unending competition and must dominate the web of life. For humanity is ultimately alone in and alienated from, and must find its lonely stumbling way through a decaying and meaningless universe. Thus modern mind has set out to conquer and exploit what it saw as a dead universe that held no stories. So what I'd like to do now is stop for another minute or so and have you turn to your partner again and talk about what's come up for you so far. What reactions are you feeling right now at this point in the readings? So go ahead and pair up. And actually, did we had someone else join? Okay. Two. Okay. Would you mind working with Anne?
Yep.
And then you two? Okay. So what strikes you so at this point, at this stage?
Is that all there is?
If your partner hasn't had a chance to speak yet, finish your thought and let your partner give a chance, get a chance. Well, it doesn't stop there. I'll explain. Yes, yes. Okay, if you could finish your thought and bring your attention forward. This is the hard part. No. Nah. Well, yeah, why not?
You should never set us off in the first place.
I'm sorry?
You shouldn't set us off in the first place.
Oh, shouldn't have sent you off on that one?
Oh, yeah.
So what, tell me more. Yeah, I know, that's a hard one. So, thoughts that came to you. Anyone we care to share? Go ahead.
Gore and I were talking about the evolution of the ancient mind and the modern mind. And
mm-hmm.
We kind of ended up thinking that this sense of separation was like a sense of freedom.
Hmm.
Well, where my thought is that the coming of the modern mind was a rebellion and a liberation from domination by a church-based society. And it's hard for us today to see it that way, because a lot of the things of the modern mind are kind of what's doing the world in. And yet we have to understand why that happened.
Mm-hmm.
It was a breaking free. It was saying, the world before was all dominated by a god who was interpreted by the go-betweens of the church. And they had
yes.
all the power.
And that is also modern mind.
Right.
In what I have here, modern mind started 10,000 years ago. So modern mind started telling that story of separation where you had to have that moderation between you and reality
mm-hmm.
with the person who bestowed things and then took money and grain and whatnot so they could support themselves. So that story of separation really got wound up with that story of science. So yes, a lot of science rejected that worldview, but it still continued with the story of separation. That we are separate from one another, we are separate from each other, we're separate from each other, we're separate from the cosmos, we're separate from creation, we're separate from the web of life. And we can do whatever we wish to the web of life without consequence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Says who.
So, what's that?
Says who.
That was the story. I didn't say that was what, because we can't. We're learning that right now. Perhaps I'll tell you what. Why don't I'm going to go ahead and continue. Unless there's one more thought. Go ahead, please, Betty.
It reminds me of a lyric of Leonard Cohen, where he says, "It looks like freedom, but it feels..." feels like death is something in between, I guess.
So part of the reason why I stopped at that point is that I was talking with a group of folks in a healing center up in Vancouver Island, and they were all really depressed at that story of Modern Mind. My God, a dead universe. And they were really like, this is awful. And I thought, oh, I'm so sorry, I should have kept going. And they said, no, we need to feel the grief. We need to feel how much it hurts to feel, to have that story. I still am working through that story of working that grief out, of feeling like I don't belong here.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people take lifetimes. They're probably going to take a lifetime. So that's why I felt important to stop at that particular point rather than just roll right on through. Because there is a third story that is emerging. And it's really funny because this third mind, or the planetary mind, depending on who you talk to, started emerging somewhere between a century, century and a half ago with the New Thought churches that began to emerge out of Christianity in the West. And although there are people from the 60s says, oh no, it started in the 60s. That's when planetary mind really got going. And I'm not going to argue with that. But this is the mind that's emerging that is looking at, or is it's emerging out of Modern Mind and Ancient Mind. And let me just go ahead and read to you. And the overarching story that planetary mind is now creating for itself is this. We'll wait for them to, Modern Mind, to roll on by. The creative force of the infinite flows throughout and embraces the universe, whole and complete, ever-changing, ever-creative, and ever-destructive. As the infinite plays and dances, as it seizes catastrophe to create anew, as it yearns for ever greater order, ever greater complexity, ever greater consciousness, and ever greater elegance, as it drives itself toward life. We are thus made in the likeness of the infinite. We are this creative force of the infinite manifest in the form of a human being. We are an integral part of the ways of the universe, and are subject to the lessons of the web of life. And along with the tiniest particles flashing in and out of existence, along with the most enormous clusters of galaxies stretching millions of light years across, we too belong to the infinite. We too are a sacred expression of the infinite. It has always been thus. We never were separate. We can awaken to a deeper communion with Earth, know and love our place within her web of life, rejoice in her, and share in her bounty. And we do so with gratitude, respect, and humility. For we know that while we have learned much, there is still much to learn as planetary mind awakens within the holy universe. So that is the story that the sage tells of the emerging mind that is happening now. And partially in response to what I talk about is the great transformation. It is already happening. Are anyone here familiar with Joanna Macy's work or David Corton? Is anyone actually familiar with David Corton's work?
Mm-hmm.
He's the founder of Yes Magazine, wrote a book called When Corporations Rule the World, a happy book. But he also yeah. He also wrote a book called Agenda for a New Economy. And he's actually bringing a lot of spirituality into the story of economics, which is horrifyingly void of it. You know, you don't talk about love, you don't talk about beauty when you're talking economics, unless it's like a price tag on it. So, at any rate, so this is the story that the sage tells, and then the second part of the book talks about what are the implications of this story. What do we do with this story? What do we do with the fact that we're going through this great transformation? And I want to see if I want to read this. Okay, here's one. So the sage dives into the story of what does it mean for us collectively? What are the stories of modern mind that need to change? One of them being, how do we hold the web of life? As a resource or as bounty? That's one story that needs to change. And here's another story. This leads to a related story told by modern mind, said the sage. Imagine this. How might you feel if you were suddenly stranded deep in the middle of the forest? Not at all happy, said the seeker. Cold, hungry, alone, definitely in big trouble. Even though you likely would be surrounded by food and everything you would need to make shelter if you only knew what to look for. But even if you had this knowledge, said the sage, and were able to take care of yourself, what do you imagine life would be like in the wild? It'd still be a struggle, constantly looking for food, storing it away from raccoons or bears or whatever else might be out there. Exactly, said the sage. That is a sense that modern mind holds towards the web of life, one of mistrust at best and hostility at worst. It sees a web of life that is actively and decidedly unfriendly. Why else would you want to conquer nature? You don't conquer something friendly. Modern mind clings to civilization, believing that it would perish from direct exposure to the web of life. The story modern mind tells itself is that life in the wild, in the heart of the web of life, is alien and hostile. This story scares it into believing that it is much better to be severed from the web of life, to control and conquer it, to avoid the capricious and inimical nature of the web of life. Yeah, that's it, said the seeker. If you're in the wild, you better watch out or the wild will kill you. The sage laughed. Oh, yes, indeed it will. But is this always true? Is the web of life always unfriendly? Indeed, is the universe unfriendly? Well, the web of life provides food, shelter, and all that, and you've said that the infinite wants life. But if I make a mistake, I'm dead. I'd say it's both, said the seeker. Exactly, said the sage. The universe simply is. The web of life owes life to none and freely offers it to all. If you pay attention, or watch out, as you say, if you know what to look for and stay connected with the web of life, it will more than provide for your needs. I would even say that the struggle to commune with and work with the web of life, rather than being something to avoid, is essential to a fulfilling life, essential to creating beauty and joy. Struggle, as is thriving, is inherent in the great mystery of the infinite. So that gives you a little taste of some of what the dialogues go into. And what I want to do now is I want to read you this last piece. The dialogues also go into personal story. What are the stories you're telling yourself? How do they relate to the larger stories? Where does the story of gratitude fit in? And how does that relate to your work in the Great Transformation? So, somebody, were you?
I was wondering what the last line was about struggle. Just
okay.
If you want.
Yeah. Is it all right if we stay a little later, folks? Okay. Yeah, this one was a little hard. Struggle, as is thriving, is inherent in the greater mystery of the infinite. If we didn't struggle, we wouldn't be alive. If our great-great-grandmother 2 million years ago didn't suffer hunger and then do something about it, we wouldn't be here. Which really is hard for me to get my head around. That in a really strange way, life is struggle. You know, that translation that is often called life is suffering, it's actually not the exact translation, but that's the Buddhist, mm-hmm. Supposedly one of the first teachings of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
That translation, I found out, is actually not quite right, but let's go with it. Life is suffering. As if that's a bad thing. That's just merely a statement. So we feel suffering and we feel joy. You kind of have to have one with the other. So... Did that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did that help? Wandering off into wild places. All right, suffering and joy. So let me read to you, I wanted to read to you one of the pieces that the main book closes, well, towards the end of the book. And then I have another question for you, and we'll take other questions that you might have. And then there's a piece that I want to close with. So at this point, as I was saying, the dialogues move into how do you start reconnecting with the infinite? And this is the part of the book that could have been 300-400 more pages that I just had to stop somewhere. But the sage talks about the temple of the infinite, that perhaps it's time for us to come out of our buildings, out of our mosques and churches and temples, and really start to connect with creation, that we're probably, the sage is foreseeing, probably it's time to move away from belief and more into communion. That mysterious, without really having to understand everything. And the seeker, at a certain point, ponders whether or not, are we going to wake up in time? Are we going to really wake up in time to stop the sixth mass extinction, to stop global warming, to do what needs to do in order to prevent this catastrophe that we're driving ourselves toward? And here's what the sage says. I think we will. As I sit here in this temple and look out at the decorated sky, listening to the chorus of waves and shorebirds, I remember. I remember that the infinite has been driving itself to greater order and beautiful complexity, to greater consciousness for billions of years. I remember that I am bathing in this cosmic stream that carries me on this delightful journey. I remember that we are much larger than we think. We are not meaningless specks on an insignificant planet in a vast, heartless universe. We are instead dazzling flashes of brilliance on a tiny but delightful, sacred sparkle of stardust called Earth. The infinite could not be 1 millimeter smaller and still be able to call us into being. The universe worked patiently for billions upon billions of years to create us. There is a place for you in the web of life, a place for you in the universe. You never were separate from the infinite. She fell silent once again, and they sat basking in the starlight. So, once again in your dyads, curious to hear more of what your reactions are, if you would talk about your reactions. And it would be fun to hear a little bit about the first time I've used the personal pronoun to describe the sage. I've been dancing around that all night. So I'd be curious to hear the answer to the question of how many of you saw two men talking at the start of the evening? So go ahead and just talk about that. Did you see a man? Did you see a woman? Or did you see something else? So go ahead and take a couple minutes with that question. So if you haven't had a chance to speak, go ahead and switch and let the other person have a chance to speak. Okay, another few another 30 seconds or so, wrap up your thought.
Our sense of superiority makes us we're missing. It's like animals. Senses. And we don't even know what they are because we don't have the senses. The only senses we have is the tangible ones. So those kinds of things we've lost.
So I am curious, how many people saw the sage as a man?
I didn't think about gender.
Okay. How many saw?
It was a woman in the beginning.
There was a woman.
You said she.
I said
and
she.
Saying that was the woman.
That was part
the
of the story.
Stream, but somehow it came to me that you were talking about a woman because I was sort of surprised. It's like when women say, when people say now God, she, you know, and then we go, what?
So you saw a woman for some, yeah.
And I thought that you had defined the stage.
Okay.
Oh no, I bet you I saw it in here.
Oh, that's what you looked ahead.
Oh, that's what it was.
Wow. How many people saw some kind of asexual sage-like person?
Sort of.
Okay. How many people saw a woman?
One.
You saw a woman?
No, actually, I came in a little bit late, and my associate here came in a little bit later than that.
Okay.
And we were just discussing how, not having read your book, and or missed the early introduction, as to whether you made any comment to what they were.
Mm-hmm.
The word that this young lady here came up with was
anthropomorphizing?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't pronounce it.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk
Thank
about
you.
It.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I know anthropomorphization really well. I do it all the time.
Human attributes.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, does it matter?
That's
we
the.
We each see. I will immediately go to the male formality of an expression. That's my point of view.
Yes, and that is mine too. That's what's been inculcated into me.
And I have some difficulty, I will admit, I have some difficulty, but I understand the beauty of the feminine and the attributes and the wisdom that can come from that direction.
Mm-hmm. And is missing.
It is seriously missing.
Desperately.
In our current society,
yeah.
Modalities, government, way of being.
Yeah. When I actually went back, the first few drafts, it was two men. Two white guys.
Well, of course.
Old guys.
Of course. Well, I mean, yeah. Well, they weren't in suits. At least they weren't in suits.
They weren't in suits?
No.
Oh, okay. That's good. That's good.
Say the sage had black curly hair. So, but yeah, at a certain point, I mean, part of the, and the reason why I do this, by the way, and the reason why I actually spring the surprise, both in the book and also when I talk, is to bring to light that we still have a lot of conditioning within us that says only women, well, I mean, only men can be sages. However wrong that is, it is still there. There was a, one of my early readers, when she got the manuscript, she's an African-American woman. She was reading it, got to that point, very early in the book, she saw she, and she said, the book, it just, she just slapped it down on the table and said, oh my God. She walked away. Couldn't believe it. I saw two white guys. That's how deep it is in me. Not only male, but white. So, and the reason why I find this is so important is that the whole issue of social justice is not related to the issue of the ecology, the ecological issues we're facing. It's the same. The same worldview that sees throwaway species, throwaway forests, will also see throwaway people. And I think it is a vital point that our spirituality is beginning to actually encompass a lot. When I go to Unitarian churches or Unity churches, or actually even the more liberal Christian churches, they're saying, "Wait a minute, there's something going on here. We need to rectify something." And I think it's vital work, very important work. So go ahead, we'll take one more, and
well,
then.
I'm just thinking about the whole sage seeker idea. So the sage is older, you're assuming, I'm assuming, he or she is the expert.
Yes. Oh yeah. In fact, there's a part in the dialogues where she says, "Well, I'm willing to continue working with you as long as you don't see me as some all-knowing sage." The sage is a kind of a handy name of someone who is like all of us, who has some part of the truth. So, and in fact, it's revealed about a chapter later that she's also from Africa. From Southeast Asia.
Spoiler alert.
I already did that. Reason why I'm doing the spoiler alert is this. You might have heard this on NPR. I didn't realize this, but this was on NPR a while ago. When someone was asking me, well, who is the sage? And I was thinking, and still do think, that who am I as a white guy to speak for a woman who's a woman of color? But I knew I had to try, otherwise it was just two white guys, which is... That's what got us in trouble in the first place, I mean, really. So, you know, I had to at least make the attempt to put words into a woman character. But this young woman, 14 years old, got up on stage at Bioneers as I was pondering this question. And she got up with her group called Destiny Arts. She was part of this group of young people who were taken off the streets in the hard parts of the Bay Area. And taught dancing and martial arts and spoken word. And this is what she wrote to the dance that the Rest for Truth did. The scene is, what are you? What are you? The group says. People look at me and try to place me in their set categories. Are you Punjabi? Mexican? Arab? You're not black with that hair. I want to say that I'm the daughter of my father, daughter of my mother, daughter of Oakland. My history is like collard greens, homemade tortillas, and creme brulee, things that should not sit together on the kitchen table. If you cut me up in a million pieces and deported me to my homeland, you'd find me on all continents. I find homage in the slave and the slave master. Grandfather the conqueror, grandfather the conquered. I'm mixed like the ingredients on my kitchen counter, some part African, European, Australian, Jamaican, Japanese, gumbo pot for the soul. And I heard that, I thought, I realized that the sage had written itself, because I sure didn't do it on purpose, as a metaphor for that part of humanity that our modern mind has denigrated for centuries and held down. And that is a huge part of the work that I think we need to do as we move into what I call planetary mind, or whatever this new mind is. So what I'd like to do then, I'll have one more piece to close. Before I close, just a couple of questions I had here. How did you all find out about tonight? I'm curious, just to do a little marketing. You found out, all right, how did you find out about it? Tonight? Yes.
Yes, you.
Well, I have a connection with Many Rivers.
Okay. How many found out about through Many Rivers?
Email list.
From Many Rivers.
And although I was debating whether to come or not, Cindy Eastoke actually asked me to come by and
oh, yeah, I missed that last
and
week.
She can't make it.
Okay.
She's a lot of things going on in her world.
Yes.
And so I'm here as an ambassador.
Okay.
Capacity. You know, she's got your book. Okay?
Yeah,
I made
she
her,
does.
You know, I cleaned house for her. And I saw it in many places in her world. So
if you'd like, I'm passing around a clipboard if you want to join my mailing list. All right, so Many Rivers. Who else heard about it otherwise? How else? Go ahead, Patrick.
I just learned through Larry Robinson.
Larry Robinson, okay. Mm-hmm. Anyone else, Larry Robinson's poetry? What's that?
You sent it out too, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
I got it from you too.
Okay, all right. Anyone else? Who else did not hear it from either me or Many Rivers? Where did you hear about it from, Ann? The Many Rivers? Okay, all right. All right, great. Your marketing is working. So I would like to acknowledge Rob and Jim. Thank you so much for opening up your bookstore to these events. This is very, I really appreciate that. So what I'd like to do then is I'd like to close with one piece that came out of a snit fit I was having about this whole family values garbage that was going on a couple of election cycles ago, how important family values were. And I was just throwing a fit because it isn't the family that we need to take care of. We need to take care of communities. I mean, the smallest human unit is not a family. That's like splitting the atoms out of a molecule. You don't have a molecule anymore. You need to have the whole thing. You need to have the community to raise the children. You need to have that. So I started writing this piece, and then it was taken over by something. So, and this has to do, this particular piece addresses how big are we really, or how small are we really? And it's called The Smallest Vessel. What is the smallest vessel that can hold a human being? Certainly it is more than the skin and bones that contain the pulsing of the individual life within. One human cannot forever stand alone and separate. Even the wise woman who lives in the forest apart from the others serves as the wise woman for those others. The smallest vessel that can hold a human being must include at least another human being. But two humans together cannot forever stand alone and separate. They need young ones to raise and teach, to help with the daily chores, and finally to take charge and carry on as the elders grow old, their bodies dying, releasing their starlight, and becoming stardust once again. The smallest vessel that can hold a human being must include at least the family. But the family could not forever stand alone and separate. It needs others to help in the gathering of food, the building of shelter, and in caring for those who are sick or hurt, just as it helps those others in its own time of need. The family needs others to bind together with in times of catastrophe, of want, and of war, as well as to rejoice with in times of plenty and of peace. The family needs others to share in the knowledge of Earth's gifts and to learn the ways of the wise old ones. The smallest vessel that can hold a human being must include at least the clan. But the clan cannot long survive alone. It needs oxygen to breathe, food to eat, and waters to quench its thirst. It needs medicines to heal those who are sick. It needs insects to pollinate and clean this forest, savannas, deserts, and prairies. It needs jaguars, hawks, turtles, sparrows, trees, flowers, vines, and all manner of animals and plants, both seen and unseen, to to teach the wordless songs of the infinite. The smallest vessel that can hold a human being must include at least the web of life. But the web of life could not long survive alone. It needs a mother willing to share her flesh, air, water, the makings of soil, and the mixing together of life-giving elements so that the web of life could form itself out of her own body. The smallest vessel that can hold a human being must include at least Earth herself. But Earth could not long survive alone. She needs a star to draw light from, to warm her creations, to cause the clouds to form, the winds to flow, the winds to blow, and the rains to fall. She needs a moon to steady her as she dances spinning through the seasons and to cause her oceans to pulse with life-giving tides. She needs planets, comets, asteroids to pull and push and sometimes collide with her and stir the cauldron of creativity. The smallest vessel that can hold a human being must include at least the sun and his children. But the sun and his children could not long survive alone. You can see where we're going with this. They need a galaxy of stars, forming, living, dying, exploding, creating the elements for life. They need a billion seeds, a billion possibilities, and the death of the grandmother star to create that one precise possibility that caused our sun to be born and his children to emerge. The smallest vessel that can hold a human being must include at least the galaxy. But the galaxy cannot have come into being alone. It needs forces, particles, and fire spinning forth from the first callings of the infinite, forming into billions of colossal galactic clouds spiraling out into the primordial cosmos. The smallest vessel that can hold a human being must include at least the universe. But the universe cannot have come into being alone. It needs an unfathomable mystery, a time of no time, a place of no place, a beginning of all beginnings, so that the infinite could then call forth the universe, and the universe could explode into being. Therefore, the smallest vessel that can hold a human being, that could hold you yourself, hold all beings, must include the whole of the infinite, at the very least. Thank you so much. Thank you for your attention tonight. I appreciate that.
Thank you on behalf of Many Rivers. We have a couple of announcements, as usual. We have our Donna Bowl, our donation bowl, over in the counter. We encourage you to contribute to it. And we share the proceeds from that generosity with our speakers to further their work and retain the other half to maintain this space. I will point out that the book is right here, purchasable tonight. Take a look at it. No doubt our speaker would be happy to sign a copy. And thank you so much for coming to Many Rivers. We look forward to seeing you at future events. Good night.